Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts. My name is Andy Boyd. I'm talking today with Andrea Warner, author of Buffy St. Marie, The Authorized Biography. Andrea, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm so delighted to be here.
I really enjoyed the book. I'm a big Buffy St. Marie fan, you know, recently minted, but quite passionate Buffy St. Marie fan. I mentioned before we started recording, I saw her this summer. She did a free show in a park in Brooklyn near where I live. And I'd heard the Illuminations album, but I didn't have any idea what she'd been up to lately. So I was quite surprised in a very nice way with what the concert turned out to be. I'm curious.
Like, that's so nice. Yeah. Sorry. I just want to like, it's so nice to see her live because like, you don't know that it's going to be kind of, I think, a life-changing experience.
Yeah.
You know, like it's, and anyone who actually gets the chance to see her live, it inevitably does really sort of move something in their lives. There's a shift.
Yeah. There was a moment, there's at this venue, there's a sort of like barricade between the free area and the VIP pay for your tickets area. And during Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, a bunch of kids just jumped the barrier and ran right up to the stage. It was a great, great rock and roll moment.
That's amazing. I love that so much.
So I've told you kind of how Buffy St. Marie found her way into my life. What about you? How did you first encounter her music?
Well, I think, you know, like a lot, I'm Canadian. And so I think like a lot of Canadians, you know, Buffy St. Marie is sort of like a name and almost like a myth. You know, you just grow up knowing her. And, you know her name, you know, maybe a few of her songs. And I didn't, you know, I wasn't like hugely familiar with her work growing up. And I've been writing about music for, you know, like a relatively long time. And when I started working at CBC Music in Canada, so like the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, mm-hmm. I really wanted to think about what it meant to be quote unquote Canadian music, like what goes into Canada. And so, mm-hmm. you know, obviously I went in with lots of knowledge about say like Joni Mitchell or Neil Young or Leonard Cohen. And I started thinking about like, well, Buffy St. Marie was absolutely of that same sort of generation and the same songwriting prowess. And we just don't hold her, or we didn't hold her, I think, in the same esteem. Like she was always sort of the one who was an afterthought, it felt like, to mainstream Canadian media. And so I just started like to unpack a bit of that, and I was writing more and more about different artists and sort of really thinking and trying to challenge myself about what it meant to be Canadian. I'm a white settler. You know, Canada is a colonial foundation. And so I just wanted to sort of think more about my participation in that and my benefits from that and the privileges and stuff. And then suddenly 2015, Power in the Blood came out. Buffy's sort of like, it was her first record since 2008. And I had an opportunity to listen to the record. I was blown away by it. And then I had a chance to interview her for CBC Music. And I was trying to do like all of this research. And there was really like kind of frankly very little information to be found, you know, like there just wasn't the same kind of if I was doing another interview with like, you know, another iconic artist of similar age and similar discography, there would be tons of resources everywhere. I would be able to flip to a Rolling Stone or, you know, just any kind of like long lasting musical archive or like a media and public record. And there just wasn't that experience for Buffy. And so I just was very frustrated. So I got ready for the interview and we had this great conversation and I just loved it so much. And, you know, when you're interviewing people, you're thinking, I don't want this to end. Like if you're in a good interview, mm-hmm. you're thinking, oh, I don't want this to end. And I was thinking that. And then she actually verbalized it while we were in our interview. And I was just like, oh, wow. And I left thinking about that and just feeling like I really would love to, I don't know, just like I think she deserves more attention. And I would really love to maybe one day write a book about her.
Yeah. So it was kind of the Toni Morrison thing of write the book you want to read.
A little bit. I mean, I had no idea that she would say yes. Mm-hmm. I also knew that I did not want to write a book that did not have her full enthusiastic participation and consent. I was really surprised that that she ultimately did say yes, because I think a lot of people had been asking her over the years and she had said no. And so I was just like a little bit hopeful, because we had, you know, that nice interview time and I had written about her work a little bit more and it turned out that she was a fan of my first book and I didn't know that.
Hmm. Do you think part of it, I mean, I think a big sort of part of the book is Buffy's kind of marginalization as an indigenous person, as a woman in the music industry, which is often and especially was in the 60s and 70s dominated by white men. Do you think part of the connection between you and her may have been that you're a woman music journalist and that's becoming less uncommon, but is still, you know, not exactly the norm?
Oh, for sure. Like, I think, you know, I mean, definitely one of one of the things that I've always wanted to do as a writer, because I think I've been writing for like over 20 years and I've been in a lot of spaces that are really quite specifically like male dominated. And it's hard, you know, it's hard to show up and be one of the only people in the room. And Buffy has experienced that over and over and over again. So I knew that like what I could do is I think, you know, provide a feminist framework and centered in music criticism where I was able to, at the very least, like empathize and relate to aspects of her experience over her career. And I think that's kind of what she partly related to in my first book. We Ought to Know, like she thought it was funny, and she also appreciated that I wanted to just try and like make space for women in the music industry, and I think like I think she was intrigued by those two things.
One of the things you mentioned earlier was being interested in kind of the Canadian-ness of Buffy St. Marie. And I'd like to ask you about that, because I feel like she is identified with Canada, but I'm not exactly sure sort of why, you know, like she was born in Canada, but, you know, raised in New England and, you know, spent most of her life, I think, in the United States and lived in Hawaii for a long time, maybe still lives in Hawaii. I'm not sure. So why do you feel like, I mean, I get the sense that she's much better known in Canada than she is here.
Oh, yeah, for sure. She is.
Why is that? Why do we think of her as Canadian?
Well, I mean, I think there's like a lot of kind of interesting things maybe there. Like she herself will tell everyone she's famous in Canada. Nobody knows her in the U.S. And I mean, I think that's an exaggeration. Like I've been on tour with her in the U.S. and people are very excited to see her and go to her shows and stuff. But yeah, in Canada, she's absolutely an icon. And, you know, I mean, part of that, I think, is that we do have this very, you know, fraught and horrifying history of the 60s scoop and the, you know, the influence of the church and white supremacy going in and removing Indigenous children from their homes and their reserves and adopting them out. And I think when Buffy was like, part of her story was that, you know, to her knowledge, she had been adopted out of Canada. And so when she went back and, you know, was able to sort of meet and be reconciled and reunited with that adopted or with her biological family, or her presumed biological family, I should say, you know, people, I think, really wanted to celebrate that story. I mean, that's a very deep, deep emotional story of, you know, this acknowledging, I think, and like the violence of being taken away from your birth family. And then the process of that reunion is a really meaningful story. It played out earlier for Buffy than for so many other people. And it, you know, it's an answer to a story that a lot of other people have also experienced in Canada, Indigenous people specifically. And not a lot of other people have that kind of answer. Even if it's not fully answered, mm-hmm. they are missing that component of their story. There's not a reunion that is always possible. And so I think that's part of it. I think as well, you know, the singer-songwriter component of it, Canada is also home to Joni Mitchell, Neil Young, and Leonard Cohen, three, you know, incredibly important songwriters of that time who all really like established themselves in America in different ways. Buffy always kept coming back to Canada and, you know, I think like also more broadly, she also wanted to come back to Canada. Like she sort of, you know, has this global perspective. She travels all over the world and she has lived in Hawaii for a lot of times. She straddles so many different spheres, but it's always been like kind of important for her to come back, specifically to, you know, Paiapot, come back to Canada, have her feet on the ground. Like, I don't know. I think those things factor into it. And Canada really, at the very least, was appreciative of her voice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I sometimes feel like Canada is a little further along in the conversation about reconciling with being a colonial nation than the United States is. I feel like that's something that we're sort of just starting to talk about. And it seems like Canada has been talking about it for, you know, 10 or 20 years in a much more public way.
Yeah. And I think, part of that has to do with just it just celebrated its 150th anniversary a couple of years ago. So it's a newer colonial institution than the States. And I think it also, that sort of newness means that our history is just very, the intergenerational trauma of that history is very present.
Can you talk a bit about Buffy's childhood? You mentioned that she was adopted out of Canada, grew up in New England. What was her childhood like? And what was the place of music in her childhood?
Yeah, you know, I think she describes it really as sort of music saved her. Mother Nature saved her. The creation, sort of like that space of creation really saved her. And I think it ties in together for her so much that just that combination of music and nature, like she really, I think, holds them as being incredibly sacred and natural and occurring within her. I think like that has been part of her life since childhood. I mean, she was, I think, 3 when she started noodling around on the piano, and I mean, and she didn't noodle. Like, I mean, she was she could play everything back that she heard. She was hearing music in her head. She, you know, it was kind of a space of liberation and creative liberation, I think, too, you know. And it wasn't, she didn't have an easy childhood. There were lots of things that were happening, but she was, you know, experiencing abuse and sexual abuse, and there weren't a lot of places where she felt perfectly safe. You know, the only places were sort of like when she kind of retreated into the woods and animals and music and her mom, Winifred. Like, Winnie was a place of safety for her, and then music and nature. And she was hearing a lot of talk at school and from other people that, you know, Indigenous people didn't exist, so she couldn't be Indigenous, but she very visibly, you know, looked quite different than the largely white town that she was growing up in. And she looked different than, you know, the family she was being raised in. So I think there were a lot of really challenging circumstances for her, but she really always has been sort of deeply rooted in positivity, and she really found a lot to, I don't know, just like a lot to hold close to her in nature and in music.
Something about Buffy St. Marie's activism around Indigenous issues that you talk about a bit in the book, and that I think comes across really well in her music, is that she doesn't really lay the blame for the abuses of colonialism on like individual white settlers, but really sort of approaches it as like, this is information you were never taught. Like, you were, this was specifically erased from the history books. And so now you're learning about it through a 3-minute rock and roll song, because you should have learned about it, you know, 40 years ago when you were in school, but that's not your fault. And, you know, better late than never. Do you feel like that sense of a kind of like generosity of spirit is in some ways rooted in her childhood? I mean, you mentioned her mother being a kind of constant source of support for her, and they maintained a relationship into her adulthood, even though this was also a person who had participated in colonial violence by adopting her out of her original, you know, cultural context. Do you think that's kind of rooted in that experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's not really, you know, I think it's a really hard thing to sort of have a broader cultural context for what feel like, you know, you're the very real maternal familial relationship you feel to your mother. Like, I think where she really places a lot of her decisions about her songwriting and her like deliberateness in her songwriting and the creativity in her songwriting is sort of a little bit more rooted. Well, yes. One, in like growing up around a lot of whiteness and sort of like, she knows how to navigate whiteness, you know? But she also never reduces colonialism to whiteness. She talks about hierarchies and pecking orders and stuff. And part of that, I think, is she was very interested in philosophy, and that's what she studied in university, as well as teaching and teaching methodology. She studied to be a grade one teacher. So she's taking these two very seemingly different approaches, as well as her own lived experience, and then bringing that into her philosophy, which is like, if only you knew. If only you, listener, understood what is happening in Indigenous communities, the reality of Indigenous communities. And that's with both the, you know, the colonial sort of exploitation and genocide and cultural sort of extermination, but also the Indigenous resistance and joy and the ongoing beauty of indigeneity. So I think she's taking all of that, and then she's putting it in like songs that are anywhere between 3 and 7 minutes. And it's kind of I mean, it's kind of incredible. But I mean, that's why she's, I think, able to endure, and she's able to get her communicate so beautifully, is that she isn't interested in shaming people for ignorance, no matter what. She is always interested in giving them the information. And her attitude is, you wouldn't yell at a 5-year-old. You have to just help them along.
Right. White people are 5-year-olds in a sense.
Honestly, yeah, like that. Yeah. And we are. Like, or I mean, I'm sorry. I don't actually know if you're white. But
I am. But yeah, that's
fine. But yeah, like I do. It's a much more generous place than, you know, for example, I operate in. I get mad all the time. But like, I have the privilege of getting mad. And, you know, it's. Again, there's so many different things that go into who is allowed to be mad and who isn't. And so I think about that a lot, too. But I just think, like, you know, Buffy has lived in this world and had this philosophy, you know, from childhood, and this like very strong center from a time that I cannot fathom, like just having that sort of like that strength from, you know, being like 4 years old. And she's just continued to sort of like cultivate that and grow into that. And like, it's kind of why she has this incredible, I don't know, kind of like glowing wisdom about her. It's wild.
Yeah. Yeah, that issue of anger comes up in the book quite a lot. That's kind of, you know, a lot of white critics responding to her music have always thought that it was, you know, this very angry music, and that she must be this very angry woman. But that's really not what's there, and that certainly isn't the version of Buffy that comes through in her concerts or in the interviews that you quote in the book.
Yeah, it's white. I mean, I think that's white critics bringing, again, always that white lens. Like, and this is one of the problems we have, like, in a historical musical record of, like, whiteness being the pervasive lens over and over and over again is, like, we as, like, white writers get in the way a lot. And we've been lied to that, like, this is objectivity. And we've participated in that lie, and we've believed in that lie because it makes us feel good. But like, yeah, it's just another kind of like cultural lie, and we have a chance to sort of like address that now, I think.
Is that kind of methodologically part of why you decided to use so many like long block quotations from your interviews with Buffy in the book, that you kind of want to present her story as much as possible as she understands it and as she sort of narrates it?
Yeah, I think it's really important to have this book in particular be as much in Buffy's own words. Like again, I think I can provide a feminist and cultural critical framework for it, but I don't, particularly as like a white writer, I don't need to be inserting my gaze there. You know, Buffy can tell her own story. I think everyone should be allowed to tell their own story. And what I can do is just provide a framework for that. And, you know, it's also one of my friends, Hannah McGregor. She's a scholar and actually like a scholar of media and podcasting. And she described my work as consent-based journalism with particular regards to the book. And I think that feels good to me. Like, honestly, that feels extremely good to me. And I know it sort of flies in the face of what we're trained to think of journalism as, but my hope is always that like, I'm not purely extractive as a writer. I think there's just so much more that we can do with media, and storytelling by having just better conversations about whose stories we're telling, how they get told, and, you know, what sort of is becomes part of that public record, and who's missing from those public records, you know? And I mean, Buffy's not, I mean, I, and maybe this would feel different with like a different person, but Buffy isn't particularly interested in being sainted or canonized or participating in just, you know, kind of like celebrity deification. Like, she would say to me periodically, she's like, you know, we gotta, you gotta make sure it's not too pretty. You gotta get more dirt. Yeah. I'm like, I mean, cool, but like, you know, it's not like she ever read it and was like, I don't like how you've characterized this. Like, mm-hmm. this is very much, you know, and she says this repeatedly and thinks of it this way. And I think this is really important, that it's my book and it's her story.
Mm, yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yeah, I don't really feel like you felt much of a need to, like, call her to account, you know, in the same way that you might if you were writing a book about, you know, Joni Mitchell or, you know, or someone who has made, I don't know, more questionable aesthetic, moral, political judgments in her life. I mean, you know, I'm picking sides here, but I do feel like Buffy St. Marie's on the right side of history. So it's maybe, yes, a little bit easier. Is. Yeah.
For sure. Like, Yep, she is on the right side of history, and she just is really, I think, patiently waiting for a lot of people to catch up. Mm-hmm. And I mean, she does sort of like address it in, and we talk about it a little bit, and it comes up here and there. Like, some people are critical that she isn't angrier, you know, that she doesn't have this sort of more forceful message, but I think she's right that like that kind of anger will burn you up and burn you out. And she is angry. She like absolutely is angry sometimes, for sure. Like, we all are. And it's how she chooses to sort of convey that anger. Like, she makes choices that protect her energy and protect her mental health and protect her body. And you know, she also has chosen to a certain extent, you know, how much she wishes to engage with the fame side of the rock industry.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to talk about her early career a bit. She kind of started out in the folk scene, but her influences were always kind of outside of that world, at least in part. In that way, she does kind of remind me of Joni Mitchell, as somebody who, like, you know, from the start, you could kind of tell was not going to be a folky forever.
Yeah.
Why did she, I mean, was it just that was what people were buying in sort of 1962? Is that why she decided to become a folk singer? Or was there, did she have some, you know, deeper connection to that genre?
Well, I think she actually really, she says at one point that she was like basically a journalist spreading the news. And I do think that that's actually sort of a lot of the root of a lot of folk music. So I think, right, yeah. I think she did embrace that. And she, you know, she didn't have a lot of money. She had a guitar. You can strap that to your back and travel along with it. And the scene very much with coffee houses at the time. And so she's someone who wants to create conversations in her music. I think it makes a lot of sense that, like, folk is, you know, folk is where she found at least the foundation to be able to do that in a public way. Mm-hmm. You know, even if the songs were sort of, you know, as she says, like, tuned weird and upside down, and she had these interests in like flamenco and blues and rock and all these other things, and she already wanted to do other stuff, like, I think it makes so much sense, actually, that like she became this kind of person who brings actual like stories that really mean something and say something to folk music. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think, like, when I really think about sort of the activism that's associated with folk music and protest music and things like that, I listened to her debut album, It's My Way, and like this is, I think, one of the most overtly like political records of the early 60s. Mm-hmm. Like it's because it's personal. The stories are rooted in mostly in some kind of lived experience, or at the very least, like sort of this eyewitness testimonial experience, you know, like,
yeah.
And I just think like it makes a lot of sense. Like, yes, you can hear that there are other influences and like that she'll probably take this other places, but like that's sort of the power of folk music at the time is like, you know, when she wrote Universal Soldier, America was still denying they were involved in the war.
Yeah.
So she really was spreading the news, you know, she was, as that song took flight and made its way around college campuses and onto bases and like, you know, it sort of slowly moved throughout the world because it didn't come out until 1964, but people knew it. People were singing it like it, you know, that is folk music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's like the sinking of the Reuben James or whatever. Like it's you know, the living newspaper idea.
Exactly.
I'd love to talk more about that song. I think it's kind of an incredible song. I mean, like just as a work of protest music that manages to sort of suggest that we are all complicit in the injustices of war because they're systemic. Like it's like,
yeah,
these are systemic issues, but that doesn't mean you're off the hook. That actually means that it's your fault because you're part of the system. You know, like she sings, he's the universal soldier and he really is to blame. Like she's not, you know, letting any individual person off the hook in the way that, you know, a song like Who Killed Davy Moore has always struck me as a little bit sort of just throwing up your hands and being like, well, I guess, you know, bad things just happen. But you know, no, she really wants to say, that we don't live under monarchies anymore. If somebody goes to war and fights in your name and you don't even know about it, like that's, you did something wrong, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really like, honestly, every time I clock that it's like two and a half minutes long.
Yeah.
And I honestly, my mind kind of falls like just out of my body, you know, like when you think about it, particularly as writers, like, you know, and I'm not a songwriter, but just thinking about what you can do with writing, the fact that she's able to put to a song this massive, massive challenge to the world to stop thinking of war as something that happens apart, like away from you, that you are somehow not actively like part of the problem, mm-hmm. like regardless of whether or not you are, you know, part of the military or outside of the military, or you think you're, you know, just like this person who war doesn't touch or whatever. Like she's drawing everyone into the same mirror that she's holding up. And she's holding herself to account as well. And that's, I think, like one of the most powerful things that she does is like she's never like trying to let herself off. And a lot of people seem to write from that perspective where they don't include themselves in the accountability process. But I think Buffy just always does. And that's one of the things that makes her activism and her work and her I don't know, just like her art so powerful.
Can you talk a bit about how she deals with specifically indigenous issues in her like 60s and 70s work? I'm thinking of a song like My Country, Tis of Thy People, You're Dying. I mean, she's talking about stuff in that song that I feel like most of society wasn't talking about for another, you know, 40 or 50 years after that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm just even thinking of like, In My Country, Tis of Thy People, which came out in, I always get confused if it's 66 or 67. But anyway, one of those 2 years, you know, she's talking explicitly about residential schools. And that is, you know, really a conversation that like, it obviously has been happening, outside of the like the main headlines for a long time, obviously. Mm-hmm. But she's naming something that like the last residential school in Canada didn't close until 1996. So, you know, more than 30 years before that, she is talking about the horrors of residential school and the abuses at residential school and the just even the violence of being taken away from your community. Obviously, in the last year, there have been some really traumatizing sort of, I mean, Indigenous people knew, but like now there are actual, you know, mass graves on the sites of former sites of residential schools. And we're literally seeing the cost to human life of what these residential schools did. And we're seeing that, you know, as more and more bodies are found and more bones are recovered, I guess it's the thing that the larger public needs to look at in order to really face up to what has been going on. But I mean, Buffy has been singing about this her entire career. Mm-hmm. And so again, this, you know, this idea that we, and I'm going to like the we here is really like settlers and white people, like of, you know, both the US and Canada, that we didn't know, like we knew,
yeah.
We didn't want to know.
Yeah.
You know? And so I just think like, but I think like that's one component of, you know, Indigenous realities that Buffy is singing about in her songs. The 60s and 70s were really huge with the American Indian movement and lots of grassroots activism for Indigenous rights. And there was also just like a tremendous amount of violence happening with treaty exploitations and like not honoring treaties. And that's still all going on. I mean, Standing Rock, we've just like all of these things are still happening now. And I can't imagine like from, I mean, singing about it forever and having it still be happening. I mean, Buffy always says the good news is now more people are talking about the bad news. I'm paraphrasing, but you know, as these things continue to sort of take up more space in the headlines and people start to really, I think, like start having conversations around just even acknowledging that it's happening and that it did happen and it's ongoing and that there is ongoing trauma and we can't get to a place of reconciliation without doing a lot of work. you know, I think more and more people are going to turn to Buffy's music and not just the stuff from the 60s and 70s, but like how these themes are continuing to echo in her songs today. The other really important part, I think, though, that, you know, Buffy always talks about is, you know, not just like sort of facing up to the hardship, but also just like Indigenous autonomy, Indigenous rights, Indigenous like joy, you know, basically like just letting Indigenous people live and letting them live like full, complete lives, and, you know, be having land back, like having no further sort of like political violence that they're experiencing at the hands of so many different people and institutions that are like the hands of the government. I don't know. There's a lot happening right now and there's a lot happening in her music. And I think that they will both continue to sort of like be places that we can find answers and we can also witness and then we can figure out you know, how, like through listening, through really deep listening, figure out sort of like some ways to repair some damage.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to talk about her more recent albums, especially Power in the Blood and Medicine Songs, which I think is the most recent album. And these are really rock albums. I mean, even, you know, they have elements of electronic music even in them. They're very far away from the kind of singer-songwriter music that she was making in the 60s. How did that come about? I mean, you know, she's, I don't know, in her early 80s now, right? I mean, she's late in her career to be making such a wide stylistic turn. I can't really think of anybody else who's done anything, you know, comparable in that way. I mean, I think most people kind of find their shtick and do their shtick for a while, you know? But so you know, how has she made that turn towards rock music, and you know, why did she do that, and you know, what's been the kind of effect of that?
Well, I think she's always made rock music and always made electronic music, but just like a lot of people aren't that familiar with her back catalog. So it feels sort of newer. She also does continue to sort of like deepen her, like she's always experimented. She's always been wildly experimental, and she continues to embrace like new technologies and new approaches, and work with some different producers. So I think that that also plays into it. But like, for example, you know, like she had, you know, rock songs on, like some of her, or like, so for example, like a pop song, like she wrote this song "Until It's Time for You to Go," which became like a huge pop standard. Elvis Presley, Neil Diamond, like so, like Barbara Streisand, Cher, like so many people have covered this song. And that was actually on her record in 1965, her second album. Mm. And then by, you know, 67, she was using electronic and rock and pop and sort of like broadening her sound. And then in 69, she made like, you know, the first electronic quadraphonic album and Illuminations, you know. And so she's done this her whole career. But I think Power in the Blood was a really big deal. People were fully unprepared to kind of like hear something like a bit of a club banger from a woman who was 78 at the time, or like 76 at the time. Sorry. And I think that that just like ended up kind of blowing people's minds. Like they weren't that familiar with her discography, and they had sort of associated her only with the folk movement as if she hasn't made records for the last 40 years. And it had been, you know, the last record she made had been in 2008. So it was like ripe for a new generation. And also like, I think just much more social media this time, mm-hmm. and a lot more diversity in who's writing about music in 2015 versus even 2008. I think people are just kind of floored. I know I even like who did have some in, you know, knowledge about her back catalog. Power in the Blood really floored me too. Like it really felt like it captured the energy of that moment, and that there's like a lot of possibility. There's a lot of hope. There's this just this like surge of, I don't know, excitement.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the things on that album that I think sort of sonically is so great to hear and so interesting to a listener who's not familiar with this kind of music much is how she kind of seamlessly melds rock influences with indigenous traditional music.
Yeah. Like, I mean, she, and again, something she's been doing for like a long time, like in 1976, she recorded her first version of Starwalker, which was, you know, and had powwow samples. And she has continued to sort of add to those powwow samples over and over the years. And she's got so many, she's got so much going on, but even the 2015 version of Starwalker continued to build on previous iterations. And she really does embrace the technology, that, you know, nothing like scares her. Like, and that's, I think actually that's kind of maybe what makes her quite different than a lot of other people, is she's never really calcified. Like, she's never been like, okay, I know enough now. Mm-hmm. I'm good. She is endlessly curious. She is always trying to learn more. Like, she is, when they talk about like a lifelong learner, like that's Buffy, you know, she, and so I think it like continues to play out in her music. It plays out in her relevance, you know, people just decide to stop evolving and they make themselves irrelevant and they coast on stuff that they did in, you know, a past life or whatever, or 20 years ago or what have you. They think that they don't really need to keep, I don't know, just keep like learning and adapting and evolving. And that's not her. Like, Buffy's whole thing is that she is always ripening. Like, that's her, that's one of her favorite phrases. And I think even in like Medicine Songs in 2017, you know, that's like her collection of sort of activist anthems, and there's two new songs, and like she has, you know, she called them Medicine Songs because she really didn't know what else to call them, because they're not all protest songs and they're not, you know, and activism, like that's kind of a word that, you know, I get to throw around at her, but I don't think it's a word that she necessarily thinks about herself. She's just doing what she believes is best for the world. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's what she wants to do.
And like, so she knows Mud and Peltier. Like, she's like, no, I know activists, right? Well, like part of it seems to be a kind of modesty on her part.
Well, I think like in terms of sort of knowing, yeah, there's a modesty for sure. Like, she knows that like she could show up and like bring more attention to something, and she'll do that if she needs to. But most of the time she knows that, you know, the work is being done on the ground. It's the grassroots activism. And she has so much like support and love in her heart for like what people on the ground are actually doing. Like, she knows what her place is, you know, and what she can bring to the table and what she needs, and the space that she makes to sort of like honor the people who are really doing the work on the ground floor and that community work. And she's so supportive of that. And so she never really wants to like step in front of that. Like, she wants to always sort of share the mic and pass the mic. And I think that's something we can all sort of, another lesson really from Buffy.
Yeah. You've mentioned how she's kind of always looking forward in trying to do new things and learn new things, but she's also always looking backwards. I mean, those two albums, Medicine Songs and Power in the Blood, both include songs from throughout her career. Did you ask her why she's so interested in doing that and kind of revisiting previous material and re-recording and you know, even writing new lyrics to some older songs? Did you ask her about kind of why she feels so compelled to do that?
Yeah, I think it's like, it's that sort of thing about constantly learning new information and revising and, you know, just iterations. Like, she's always sort of like an iteration of herself, you know, she's always sort of evolving into something new, and that ripening concept. I think she feels similarly about the songs. Like, mm-hmm. there's new technology. Maybe she didn't get the vocal the way she wanted to one time. Like, she really does like to sort of build on the past and bring it into sort of a more contemporary, if not futuristic, context. And mm-hmm. I think she's also very aware that, you know, a lot of her songs, most people have never heard. Mm-hmm. So if she really believes in a song and she thinks that it hasn't had a chance to do the work that it could, then she's also, you know, bringing that forward as well. And so I think that that's kind of really interesting too. It's just because she's always sort of like Buffy, the thing about Buffy I find is that like, she's kind of like spanning times, you know, she's like backwards and forwards and she's, you know, moving in a circle, and she's like everything sort of informs itself. It all collapses on itself and expands from itself. And it's like this really kaleidoscopic sort of creation that's super cool and interesting. And it's really wonderful to see the way something from 1942 is informing something in 2021 and how they have continued to sort of speak to each other across time, you know, like, and I think a lot about like even just a song like Starwalker. I mean, it is an incredible piece of like rock and indigenous powwow sample. It is a celebration of, you know, real indigenous people in her life. It is a love letter to indigenous communities and indigenous leaders and indigenous grassroots folks. And it also is a song that continues to be really exciting. Like when it's played live, like it is such a thrilling song and it's thrilling for everyone there. And then the powwow samples come on and she's singing along to the powwow samples and it's just, it comes alive. And like each version of that song kind of, I think, like captures the spirit of the moment in which it's recorded. And so I think it does become this sort of like living, growing testimonial of a song.
Well, Andrea Warner, I think that's a great place to end. Thanks so much for your book, Buffy St. Marie, The Authorized Biography, and thanks so much for being on New Books in Performing Arts to talk about it. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I'm very long-winded, so, you know, hopefully everything is okay on your end.
No, that's your job. I'm interviewing you.
Well, there's so much to talk about with Buffy, and it's just such a delight. How do you fit it all in, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.